You are listening to Studio 41.
Hello and welcome to Quiz Time India. I'm your host and quiz master, Aditya.
Hi, my name is Abhinav Dasgupta and I'm really excited to be on this week's Quiz Time India.
One of Yahoo's biggest problems.
Now, the rhyme refers to three geese in a flock.
The war fought by the French against the British.
This is about a Frenchman who lived from 1611 to 1673.
So, David Bowie used a machine called the Verbicizer.
Right, Robert Maxwell and Rupert Murdoch.
Welcome to Quiz Time India. Hello and welcome to Quiz Time India. I'm your host and quizmaster Aditya. Here is another episode full of facts, trivia and questions. Like, did you know 33% of most viewed stories on Instagram are from businesses and not from individuals? Did you know next to Qutub Minar is Alai Minar, commissioned by Alauddin Khilji? Khilji died, construction stopped. Too bad. If you like such medieval and modern gems, then you have come to the right place. Quiz Time India, India's first quizzing podcast. And up first in this episode, as always, is the matter of the audience question. In the last episode, we had Ishita Das join us on the podcast, and this was her audience question.
I'm talking about a lady, Sunali Agarwal. She is the co-founder of MobiQuick. Okay, and recently Sunali has launched an app called Aya, A-Y-A, Aya. So my question to audience is, what is this app about and how is this app unique? That's what I want to know.
And the correct answer is Aya, which stands for As You Are, is promoted as a safe LGBTQ dating app in India. And the one to give the correct answer was Aarti Nair. Congratulations, Aarti. Very well done. Thank you so much for participating. Every episode on this podcast has an audience question, which is usually towards the end of the episode. Even this episode has one, and you can answer it over social media. And now moving on to this week's episode. This week on the podcast, we have Abhinav Dasgupta. Abhinav, when he's not promoting digital payments as director at Visa, he remains one of the mainstays of the Bombay Quiz Club, where he has been treasurer since 2012. A former president of the quiz club at his alma mater, St. Stephen's College, Abhinav has quizzed in all major cities in the country. Yeah, and he has, to his credit, 4 podium finishes at the prestigious Landmark Quiz, including winning the Mumbai round in 2011. As quizmaster, Abhinav has been a regular at the annual Mumbai Quiz Festival since its second edition in 2012, having co-hosted the festival's flagship Mumbai Open Quiz in 2014, 17, 18 and 19. Along with several other quizzes in Mumbai, Abhinav has also conducted quizzes at quiz festivals and for quiz clubs in Kolkata, Hyderabad, Delhi and Pune. I am quite excited about having Abhinav here on the podcast. I have attended a few of his quizzes at the Bombay Quiz Club and it's an honor and a pleasure to have him here. So now, without any further ado, welcome to Quiz Time India. Hello, Abhinav. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. Welcome to Quiz Time India. How have you been?
Thank you very much, Aditya. Great to be here. It's a privilege to be able to speak to you.
So, Abhinav, the deal is quite simple. Over the next half an hour or so, we both will be trading trivia, trading questions, trading interesting facts that we have come across. And hopefully with us, our audience also gets to figure out some new interesting trivia, some new food for thought.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
So, the rule is quite simple. Since I am the host and you are the guest, I'll ask you the first question. If you know the answer, well and good. If you don't, and if you need any hints, please ask me for hints. I will give you hints as in I can. I'll nudge you towards the answer. And similarly, when you're asking me the questions, and if I need any hints, I'll ask you for hints. It is quizzing, but it is not so competitive as our regular quizzing.
Just the way I like it, man.
Perfect. So, Abhinav, are you ready for your first question?
Absolutely. Fire away.
All right. So, the story begins in the year 2000. This one gentleman called Louis von Ahn. He was starting his PhD program in computer science when he attended a talk And he happened to learn that one of Yahoo's, remember it is, you know, 2000. So Yahoo is one of the biggest IT or tech giants at that time. And during the talk, he came to know that one of Yahoo's biggest problems at that moment was that automated bots were signing up for millions of free Yahoo email accounts. And then they were generating tons of spam. This talk got Lewis thinking, and he subsequently came up with a solution. Can you tell me what this solution was?
Probably the CAPTCHA, right?
That perfect. Perfect. He came up with the idea of CAPTCHA. So these are the squiggly letters we type into a website to prove we are human. And the idea worked clearly. And what also happened is that he gave away the idea for free. He didn't make any money out of CAPTCHA. But now here is your main question. But years later, the same idea evolved into a new way for him to monetize, this time in the form of an app. Today, the popular app is valued at $1.5 billion. It is used globally and is seeing a big spike in growth while people are confined to their homes. Can you tell me, Louis von Ahn, the man who invented CAPTCHA, he used similar technology which he utilized in another app which seems to be doing extremely well, especially since COVID, since the lockdown? That is the question.
I frankly have no idea, but I mean, since these are the same technology, take a wild guess and say Zoom for no particular reason, just because of the fact that it's shot up in valuation thanks to COVID. In fact, I saw the share price actually sinking the day Pfizer announced its vaccine.
That is a good guess, but you are actually thinking on the right lines. So Zoom is one of the tools which has been is being used quite regularly and quite frequently ever since the pandemic hit. But that is not the answer. So, as I said, it was these squiggly letters that we use for CAPTCHA, the technology that you can write these weird letters. He used it in a different app. An app which uses these letters and machine learning to do what its job is.
Is this that... there's that Google app, right? It's called... Is it called Google Lens or one of those? The one that converts handwriting to text?
No, but you are sort of in the ballpark somewhere. Now you are at least thinking, I think you are thinking in the right lines, I could say.
No, I don't know. Sorry, I follow too well.
All right. So let me tell you something more about Louis von Ahn. I said he gave away the idea for free.
Right.
But not entirely. He did get a gig using CAPTCHA. He got a gig with New York Times. So, New York Times was having some trouble digitizing their backlog of articles, which goes up to like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And they were using machines to do it. But every once in a while, there would be words which the machine could not understand.
In fact, they actually call it the Times Machine. Because you can go back in time to read the Times. It's called the Times Machine.
Makes sense. So there were these words from the old articles, which were thousands and thousands of such words, which the machine could not translate. So New York Times gave it to Louis von Ahn, and Louis basically made those letters into CAPTCHA. So people like you and me and all over the world, we were basically helping the New York Times when we were filling in the CAPTCHA. So that was one thing that he did. He made some money out of it. But then he used that core of the technology, which was these writing letters and alphabets, into a different idea where you could teach people languages. So say if I have to teach someone Hindi, he used the technology of writing those letters into making a Hindi script, and then he put a whole lot of machine learning algorithms on top of it, and then he put that in an app which goes by the name of Duolingo. So Duolingo is the app. It has been around for a while now. And ever since the pandemic hit, of course, it has seen a great spike because people were at home and they had a lot of time in hand. So Duolingo was the answer.
Very nice. Very nice question, Aditya. I didn't know Duolingo was valued at a billion and a half. Pretty neat.
Have you used Duolingo?
No, not at all. I'm clearly not doing what most people do at home.
All right. Now, it's your turn to ask me the question.
Okay, sure.
Please.
But thank you. I think that's a tough one to match. But what I have for you, Aditya, is five questions that are largely themed on literature in some sense. But all the five are connected by a theme, right? And if you figure out the theme, you'll figure it out. If not, I'll anyway let you know. But don't worry too much about that. Just read each question on its own. So here's the first question, right? So I'm referring to a traditional children's rhyme, as it was then called. And, you know, the first time it was published in an anthology called Types of Children's Literature, a collection of the world's best literature for children, right? And it was published exactly 100 years ago, so in 1920. It's a traditional rhyme, but it was published in this anthology called Types of Children's Literature. Now, the rhyme refers to three geese in a flock, right? Three geese in a flock, two of which flew in opposite directions. Okay, that's all I'm telling you right now, and if you need more hints, I'll actually tell you what the actual rhyme is. But all I'm telling you right now is that the rhyme refers to three geese in a flock, two of which flew in opposite directions. My question is, where or how exactly did the third one fly?
All right.
If that sounds completely vague, I'll actually tell you what the rhyme is.
Okay, let me just get all the facts around. So, 1920, this anthology of children's rhymes was printed, and one of these rhymes or poems was about, mentioned, three geese.
Three geese in a flock,
In a flock, and two of them went in opposite directions, and we have to tell where did the third one go. Alright, so, is it something to do with, is it a translation of...
No, it's an English.
Is it an English poem? It's an English poem. Okay.
Very specific answer.
A geese. Okay, let me just think. I was...
Think about it, then I can tell you the rhyme. I can tell you the actual rhyme.
So, is this a part of another famous rhyme?
No. It's like a nursery rhyme. Think of it like a nursery rhyme. Traditional rhyme, anonymously written. We don't really know who wrote it, but yeah.
Okay.
It's first in print in 19.
So we have to tell which rhyme it is, no? Basically.
No, you don't need to. You just need to tell me where the third one flew. And I tell you that part, you know, where the third one flew is the title of a different book.
Aha. Okay, I have a guess because it's of the, what is the word? Ornithologically, I'm just going in those lines.
Yes.
So... It flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Absolutely right, Aditya. That's correct. So the rhyme goes like this. Wintery, mintery, cutery corn, apple seed and apple corn, wire, briar, limber, lock, three geese in a flock. One flew east, one flew west, and one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Brilliant, brilliant, Abhinav. I could imagine that. That was totally a guess.
Great answer.
That was such a rewarding question. Aha. I never knew of this. Oh, brilliant, brilliant. And of course, I'm so happy with the first question.
Yeah, well done indeed. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, book by Ken Kesey. Probably most of us are familiar with the movie, 1975 film with Jack Nicholson, Louis Fletcher, which in fact was one of the three movies to win the big five Oscars, right? Picture, director, actor, actress, and screenplay. Made a clean sweep of five.
Which other movies have done that? Ben-Hur?
No, not Ben-Hur. Actually, it happened one night in 1934. And then The Silence of the Lambs in 1991. So,
Silence of the Lambs also. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster.
And who was the director of The Silence of the Lambs? I keep forgetting his name.
Jonathan Demme, I think.
Jonathan Demme, I think so, yeah. All right, Abhinav. That question brought a smile to my face. I really would not have thought for the life of me, but that was the answer. But here we are. Thank you so much.
All right, back to you.
So, my next question is from a news item that came out recently, and I found it quite interesting, so I thought I'll make a question out of it. Have you heard of the Eurovision Song Contest?
Yes. Not that I know too much about it, but yeah, ask away. Get to know some stuff.
Huh. So it is an international song contest. It does a Eurovision. So basically, it's a song contest. Each country sends an artist or a band and they perform. And at the end, the jury picks out one winner. Now this year, due to COVID, there could not be any Eurovision, which is understandable. But the Dutch broadcasters, VPRO, that's the name of the broadcaster or the channel, they went ahead and came up with a contest which was sort of unofficial, but for all practical purposes it was called Eurovision 2020. And in this contest, each team partnered with a rather unusual partner. So each country's team partnered with something really unusual. Can you tell me who was this partner?
So you're telling me it's a different partner for each country, right? I mean, not like one single person.
Same partner.
Oh, the same partner who went with each of the countries.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it, again, sort of wildly guessing, is it someone like Smule? You know, the...
What is Smule again?
That music app thingy.
It is not Smule.
You need a person or something. Or I don't know, could it be karaoke, for instance?
It's... Okay, you are thinking on the right lines that it is not a person that we are pondering upon. Was Smule something like Dub Smash or Musical.ly or one of those apps?
Yeah, one of those things where basically you have the actual singer singing and you kind of sing to it. It's actually
good. Okay.
But no, I can't think of anything else. Tell me something else.
So, as I said, it's not human, the component which was added. It is something technological and something that has been in the news for a while. And 2018, François Pache, actually this thing has existed for a while, but François Pache in 2018 took it to a different level and created a complete new pop album, which was called Hello World with this partner. Does this help you in any way?
I vaguely remember this Hello World thing. I have no clue. Tell me more.
Okay, the album was called Hello World.
Yeah, Hello World is like basically what they teach you to code first, right?
Exactly. So there was a reason why Francois kept the name Hello World for that album. Does this help you?
Was it Alexa? Or
closish,
or CD, or one of those guys.
So I'll tell you the answer. Basically, they used an AI engine to compose music.
Yeah, okay, good enough. Yeah.
So AI music has existed for a while. Right. You can go to YouTube and you can listen to a whole bunch of AI music across genres. In 2018, François Pache composed an entire pop album using artificial intelligence, and he very cheekily called it Hello World. So this year, because every country's, you know, every performer was pretty much sitting at home in their different places. So this time, the Dutch broadcasters, VPRO, asked them to collaborate with AI. So Germany, their entry was, what they did was, they took 1950s and even before, some old recordings of church choir singing a cappella.
Oh, okay.
Fed it to AI, and then the AI worked on it. And of course, the humans also played some part in it, in some type of instrumentation. But most of the heavy lifting was done by AI. For Australia, they put sounds of koalas and kangaroos.
What is Australia doing in Eurovision?
Yeah, so it was open for all this year. It's an international thing, so I think anyone can send their entry, perhaps. But yeah, Australia... What they did was they took sounds which are made by koalas and kangaroos.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they fed them to AI, and AI used those sounds in a very sneaky manner to come up with a track. And the idea of the track was, of course, that Australia had a big bushfire almost a year back.
Yeah.
So they wanted to raise awareness about it. So that's why the koala and the kangaroo sounds and fed into AI. And actually, Australia, as I said, won the Eurovision contest this year.
Really? Wow. That's interesting. I mean, AI writes poetry as well and stuff like
that. I'm glad that you mentioned it. I was looking up about, computers and poetry. Yeah. So David Bowie used a machine called the Verbicizer.
Correct.
To randomize lyrics. Because he felt that humans can only think in certain patterns, right? So he would just take some words, throw it in the verbalizer, and the verbalizer would just rearrange the words. And some of his lyrics are actually made using that. Because he said sometimes the sense, the way computer processes or parses the words in such manner that it can have more than one sense. So Bowie has done that. And yeah, as you said, AI poetry is there.
I'm sure verbalizer wrote better than he did.
I was actually listening to some Bowie today. I'll take offense to that. All right. It's okay. Time for your next question.
Sure, thank you. So, we spoke about two birds flying east and west. My next question also has an east and west theme, right? So, sticking to this theme, the first two lines of a particular poem, it's a poem you know, it's quite well known. The first two lines of this poem are wrongfully quoted as an example of the poet's inherent racism. Now, I'll tell you that allegation is not unfounded. I mean, there are several other examples of racism in his works. But my point is that this is not one of them, right? Because if care to read beyond the first and second lines, the third and fourth lines themselves say that when two equals, in this case the English colonel's son and a border chieftain called Kamal, meet, their only criteria for judging each other are character and prowess and not accidents of birth or ethnicity or anything like that, right? So, it's not that there is a racist theme in this poem at all, contrary to what, people who just quote the two lines kind of promulgate. So, according to the opening lines, what will never happen till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat?
All right. So, a poem written by, I'm assuming, someone famous.
Someone very famous, someone we all know.
Yeah. And his works or his thoughts have been bordering on racial, racist rather.
Yes.
On quite a few instances, but this is not one of them, although it may seem like it.
Correct. If you just read the first two lines independently, that's what it seems. You read the rest of it, you know that's not it.
The following lines are, could you repeat the lines, the sun and the...
Yeah. So, the third and fourth lines say that when the English colonel's son and a border chieftain called Kamal meet, their only criteria for judging each other are character and prowess and not accidents of birth or ethnicity, right? So, according to the opening lines, and I'm coming to the first two lines that are considered racist. So, according to the opening lines, what will never happen till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat?
So, these lines, what will never happen, are the third, fourth lines?
No, they're the first and second.
Okay, so there is something in there.
Yeah, there's something in there that is, and I told you that we stick to previous, that there's a link to the previous question, right? We saw two birds flying east and west. So, that's the giveaway the answer.
Interesting. There are lots of... I'm just thinking of racist things one could say, but I can't think. I don't think that's the right line to go forward with. But let me just think.
Sure. You want more hints? Happy to.
Could you repeat the phrase, the line again? Something will never happen until the...
Till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat. And that's actually a quote, right? I'm not making up those lines myself.
Yeah. And the colonel...
Colonel's son. And an Afghan chieftain called Kamal. Border chieftain called Kamal.
Interesting. I'm now thinking who could be the poet. That's one way of thinking of it.
That's
because
the right way to think about it. Think of authors, poets who are generally regarded racist and that kind of
thing. Yeah. Is he British?
Yes.
Is he the... who's the guy who won the Nobel Prize?
Yeah, he did win the Nobel Prize, you're right. In fact, he was the first person from his country to win.
Yeah. I'm not Bernard Russell. What was his name? Not George Bernard Shaw also.
Shaw did win the Nobel too in 25, but before him.
Yeah.
Terrible decision, if you ask me, to give him the Nobel Prize while Tolstoy was still alive.
Was he born in India?
Oh, yeah, very much so. There's only one name, right? Rudyard Kipling.
Rudyard Kipling, yes. Absolutely. Okay, so it was Kipling, and now what did Mr. Kipling say? I didn't know Kipling was closet racist. or like maybe openly racist. Yeah, I didn't know about that. Okay. So what did Mr. Kipling write? Something to do with the Mowgli?
No, not to do with Mowgli.
Okay.
Although he did write that, yes.
I thought maybe he started Jungle Book with these lines. I don't know.
Shall I get it out? So this is a poem called The Ballad of East and West, right? And the first line is probably the most famous of all. It goes, "Oh, East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet. Till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat." Right? Those are the first two lines. And then it goes on to say, "But there is neither east nor west, border nor breed nor birth, when two strong men stand face to face, though they come from the ends of the earth." Right? So he actually negates what he's saying in the first two lines. Right? Typically, one often quotes this, "East is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet," saying that, you know, they're completely two different worlds. Kipling also kept talking about the white man's burden and things like that, right? And so, you know, quite often when you look at this line in an isolated way, it does seem to be racist, but then he goes on to say that, you know, there's neither east nor west, no border, no breed, nor birth, when two strong men stand face to face, though they come from the ends. So this is the ballad of East and West, and this is about how never the twain shall be.
Again, it's one of those lines that one has heard, correct, but I never knew this was the origin of it, or this was the context in which it was used, or rather written. Thank you so much. That was a good one. All right. So, the next question is something very interesting that I found recently. And it's rather ironical that this thing happened, or rather happens, that I thought, you know what, let me try and make a question out of it, and perhaps the audience will also see the humor in it, which I at least thought was slightly a twist of fate, or call it whatever you want to. So, "God Save the Queen," the British national anthem. The first recorded performance of "God Save the Queen" was in 1745. And when I say recorded, I mean it was noted rather than, you know, recording of it. So it was noted that in 1745, "God Save the Queen" was first sung, and it was sung by, there was a Drury Lane, D-R-U-R-Y, Drury Lane in London, and there was this certain kind of establishment there. And the male members of this establishment announced that they intend to form a special unit of volunteer defense force. And after the announcement, they went on to sing "God Save the Queen." So basically the idea is the male members of this establishment said they will be forming a special force, and if required, they will be ready to go and fight with the Queen's army. So that was their stance, and they made this announcement, and then they went on to sing "God Save the Queen," and the news spread. The news spread that such and such incident had happened. The local newspapers covered it. Then the news spread even further. Now it spread all over Britain. And a lot of similar establishments started following suit, until eventually the song was adopted as the national anthem. Can you tell me, what was this rather unusual establishment of whose male members started singing the To Be National Anthem? And it has a very random Indian connect too, which would be visible, I hope, after you give out the answer.
If I get the answer, that is. No, I mean, Drury Lane rings a bell. I've probably heard about it in medical cases or something, but I can't place it at the moment. Although 1745, I guess, would have been "God Save the King," not "Queen," I think.
That I need to verify, actually.
But yeah, 1745. And what has an Indian connection, did you say? The answer.
So, yeah, a vague, vague Indian connection.
So, I think...
So, this establishment, people started singing national anthem, and the news got into the papers. And of course, once it reached the papers, it reached a bigger audience, and the news reached all across Britain, and there were many other such establishments, and the members of those establishments also started singing the national anthem, and it became sort of a tradition. And eventually, with time, "God Save the Queen" got adopted as the national anthem. Before that, it was just a song, but it gained popularity thanks to these folks at this particular establishment. It's okay if you don't know the answer. I'll give you a hint because there's not much for you to play with here.
No, I'll take a guess before that. I'm just thinking of what could be ironical. Was this the place where you would have immigrants typically living and hence, thinking what becomes a national anthem is sort of ironical?
No. That's a good guess, but that is not the answer. So, this Drury Lane establishment, I'll give out the answer.
Or was it, I'll just take one more guess. Is this where the brothels were?
No. It wasn't where the brothels were.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so it was theaters. So before a performance, one day the male performers said this, and then a lot of theaters across Britain, before the performance, they would sing the national anthem, which I thought was quite funny because 200 something odd years later in India, that's what we're doing before every movie opens. We stand up for the national anthem.
I like that. Very nice. Very nice. Funda, so to say.
Yeah, so you were, as I said, there was not much to play with here, except for that I just found it quite interesting.
No, but it's good. I mean, honestly, Drury Lane, I should have recalled, is where the theatres used to be. Yes, that's right.
Uh-huh.
Very nice. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, so this is about, sort of similar timing, but a century ago from your question. This is about a Frenchman who lived from 1611 to 1673. By the name of Charles de Bots de Castelmore. Right? Charles is spelled Charles, C-H-A-R-L-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
Charles de Bots de Castelmore, who basically served Louis XIV, who was the King of France, as captain of the guards and so on. And he was killed at the siege of Maastricht in the Franco-Dutch War, right, in 1673. Now, the question is, the thing is, he had a noble title. He was Count of something. Count of a certain place, and around a couple of centuries later, his life was the basis of a very, very famous literary work from the same country, right, from France. So the question is, what was this person also known as, right? He was Count of what? Count of which place or whatever? So Count of what? Because that name was also used for the name of the character in the 19th century.
Okay, we have a theme which could help me.
Yes, exactly.
And then there is the fact that 19th century famous work.
Very, very famous, again.
Of literature.
All of us have read, if not read it, read about.
France.
Yeah.
No, not Robin Hood. One second, sorry, that's not French. Where was Don Quixote?
That was Spanish, and that was in the 17th, early 17th century. Quixote and Shakespeare apparently died on the same day.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, let me think about this. So we have an East-West theme going on, and then there is this French.
Well, the East-West is not the theme. There's a different theme, which maybe I'll reveal after the last question, unless you get it.
Quite interesting. Or maybe the theme is then... anyway, so let me go back. France, 19th century, you said, right? Famous piece of work.
Very, very famous piece of work based on the life of this 17th century guy who was a captain of the King's Guard. And this was the real guy. I mean, his name was used for that character. And it's largely a fictionalized account of this guy's life.
I'm thinking, who could it be? French. Any hints that you could possibly give me?
Yes, sure. So, see, 19th century French literature, there are probably two or three writers who come to mind. And this author, in fact, his son were both well-known authors, had the same name. And they were called, the author's name is XY, he was called XY Pear, which is father XY, and the son was called XY Peel, which is son XY, right? They had the same name, father.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by the father. it's widely translated. We've all read the book as a kid. It had a couple of very famous sequels too, although the original book is what is best known, but the sequels are also widely read.
And he, the original person on which it was loosely based, was this, the...
And okay, in fact, I'll also tell you that the story is also set in the same period, right? It is set in the 17th century, yeah, during the reign of Louis the 14th. That might help. So it's like a period romance, so to say.
A romance?
I mean, romance not in the strictest sense. You know, tale of romance is used for a tale of adventure and things like that. So...
I think this is one of those where you'll reveal the answer and I'll be like, but let me just give one more shot before we go there.
I guess. Very, very famous book.
Right now, I'm drawing a total blank when I'm trying to think of French characters or...
Name the book, that's fine. You'll get points or whatever. Virtual pat on the back.
Yeah, I am at sixes and sevens. I'm lost. You'll have to tell me the answer.
Okay. So, this person by the name of Charles de Gotz de Castelmore was the Count of Artagnan, right? So, of Artagnan is D'Artagnan, D'apostrophe Artagnan. And in which book do
we... The Three Musketeers.
The Three Musketeers, absolutely. So, this is Alexandre Dumas, who was, you know, Dumas père, and his son was Dumas fils, right?
I didn't know that, the father son thing.
Yeah, so... Alexandre Dumas was in fact mixed race. Like, I believe his father was a mulatto.
It was.
Yeah, so quite interesting. Wonderful author. In fact, most of his stories were not written by himself. He had the stories were cooked up by a different guy whose name I'm currently forgetting. But he was the one who actually put them to pen and paper. The actual plots were by someone else. And I'm completely blanking on the name, but the deal is that he, life kind of comes full circle, because Alexandre Dumas actually died in complete penury, and this guy whose name, like I said, I can't remember at all, the whole deal about him not revealing his name was, you know, him getting a lot of money in the process. So he ended up being fairly rich by the time he died. So. Yeah.
I was watching The Hateful Eight.
Right.
Have you seen the movie?
No, I have.
There's a passage about... Okay, so one of the characters is called D'Artagnan, and he is shown as a extremely racist person who is extremely violent also towards the black people on the plantation. And one of the characters draws this sort of ironical... brings it forward that, you know, Alexandre Dumas was also, as you said, mixed race, so probably he wouldn't have liked so much if D'Artagnan was a racist. But yeah, that was the answer. I did not know that again. Thank you so much for this. Yes, it's already IELTS today for me.
And likewise for me.
Who were the other two? Athos and Porthos, right?
Athos, Porthos and Aramis. In fact, the Three Musketeers, D'Artagnan was the fourth musketeer, right? So,
yes.
Athos, Porthos and Aramis were the Three Musketeers.
Also the final question from Slumdog Millionaire.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
All right. So back are you ready for your next question?
Go ahead.
This, we go to 1756 and we go to France.
Very nice. Let's
so, the multiple stories behind the origin of this food item pretty much all revolve around a war fought by the French against the British at Port Mahon on the Mediterranean island of Minorca, now a part of Spain. So French fought British in Spain. The year was 1756. The French won, and the chef of the Duc de Richelieu, I hope I'm getting the name
Richelieu,
right,
yeah,
was asked to prepare a rather grand meal, and he could not find some of the ingredients that he was looking for. I mean, it was a war at the end of it. So he improvised and he came up with something. A food item which is famous, which is still consumed throughout the world rather. Can you tell me what food item could this be? The answer is somewhere there in the question.
I'm thinking, is this the Spanish omelette?
No, that is a good guess. but no.
You said Menorca, which is Mediterranean island.
Yes.
And things in short supply, so he would...
Yeah, and this led to something which is consumed even till this day. Actually, there are a few food historians which say that this item actually came from the Spaniards and this guy took it from them. But one thing that everyone agrees is that the French definitely popularized the item. Actually, so 1756 is when this was invented. At least the story begins in 1756. By early 19th century, that is another 60-70 years later, this food item had began to appear in German and British cookbooks dedicated to French cuisine. So that means the Germans and the British knew about it in the next 50 odd years, that they started mentioning in their French cookbooks, they started mentioning this item. And that was in early 1800. And then it made its way to the United States. So a lot of French chefs migrated there to US. And it is said that in 1838, a gourmet eatery Delmonico's in Manhattan was offering this item. That was 1838. And then it spread through America until in 1923. It was probably a slow news day. And US President Calvin Coolidge, the press asked him, what is one food item that you love the most? And the US President Calvin Coolidge said that he simply could not do without this food item made by his Aunt Mary. It went in all newspapers and everyone was like, oh, this is amazing. And everyone started consuming this food item. And, you know, once things become big in America, they tend to travel all over the world.
Yeah.
And now all of us pretty much know of it. So that's the story of sorts behind this food item.
So interesting. I don't know, really is. Can't be the croissant, I mean, but probably there much.
Not the croissant.
Yeah, is this what is colloquially called French toast?
No.
No, French toast is not French, to the best of my knowledge. Most of these things with adjectives are from countries that are different from. It's like Spanish food.
Yeah, like French fries is Belgian, if I'm not mistaken.
So no, I give up. Tell me, what's this?
So okay, I'll just repeat the thing again. Let's see if you get it. So French defeated British in Spain at Port Mahon on the Mediterranean island of Menorca, Spain.
Ah, so this is... okay, so mayonnaise is what you mean.
Yes!
I think I missed the name of that. Oh, I should have just
asked. Yeah, Port Mahon.
Yeah.
And the food historians, as I said, some of them said that it was a Spanish food item.
From Mahon.
Yeah, so they called it salsa mayonesa.
Right.
And mayonesa became mayonnaise. So yeah, that was the story of mayonnaise.
I should just have asked you to repeat the name. I completely missed that name.
So the chef could not find a sauce. So he just improvised and took some eggs and butter. Started, beating them up until it got a consistency which was similar to that of a sauce. And the news spread, the story spread. It was all over France. And by early 19th century, as I said, Germany and British cookbooks dedicated to French cuisine started mentioning mayonnaise. Then the French chefs took it to America in 1838. At least we have the first mention of a store called Delmonico's in Manhattan, which was serving mayonnaise. And then in 1923, President Calvin Coolidge said that he simply could not do without his Aunt Mary's heavenly homemade mayonnaise. And then everything, that it just went.
Very nice question.
All right. Now, you turn for your fourth question.
Sure. So, we'll come from the, fancy French and English literature to something more modern, also English. But this is, I'm talking about a fairly popular novel from 1996. I'll tell you who the author is. But it's a 96 novel which chronicles the lives of these two media barons called Richard Armstrong and Keith Townsend, again immaterial. And The book is based on two real life media barons, right? Robert Maxwell and Rupert Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
So, the title of the novel is, you know, like I said, it's based on the media, right? Just keep that in mind. The title of the novel is basically a phrase that was that is largely attributed to a person called Edmund Burke, right? Edmund Burke was a member of parliament in the 18th century, very well-known orator. So, the title, and which is a very common phrase used today as well, was attributed to Edmund Burke, right, in the 18th century. So, what is the name of the novel? Like I said, it's about the media and everything else, about Robert Maxwell, Rupert Murdoch, fictionalized versions of these characters. So, which 1996 book am I talking about? I'm happy to give you the name of the author if you...
All right. So, let me just gather around all the facts. 1996 book has a name, and the book is about, as you said, two
of the feuding... media barons. Media barons.
Yeah. And the name of the book is, one could say it was coined by the Edmund Burke.
Edmund Burke. Disputed, but largely attributed to him. But it's a phrase still used very widely to refer to what I just spoke about.
And, I'm thinking of, I don't know, I'm thinking famous phrases which could be book titles.
Yeah. Two words. In addition to an article, you know, the first word is the, but
okay.
two word phrase.
Okay, that helps. Because I was thinking all Agatha Christie titles. And then there were none and things like that. Murder on the Orient Express.
Although death comes as the end and then, you know, Nicolai Dock and whatnot, but no.
So two words. Something. And Edmund Burke was in 1800, you said something?
18th century. 1797 is the year. But it's a phrase that's still widely used.
Who was the author of the 1996?
The author was Geoffrey Archer.
I've definitely not read this one. And not read actually much of Geoffrey Archer's work. But let's see, Geoffrey Archer, that is a good place to start. What was one of his famous... Okay. Actually, this is now just a guessing game for me because I don't know of the Geoffrey Archer title and... I mean, if you could give me a hint, that could help. Otherwise, I would need the answer. Because...
No, I'll give you a hint. The hint that I was withholding, I'll give you. It's a phrase used to describe the media.
Oh, that helps.
That's the one key thing I was looking for.
So, it must be the fourth pillar.
The fourth estate.
The fourth estate.
So, this is The Fourth Estate by Geoffrey Archer. And do you know what the three estates are? I mean, why is the media the fourth estate?
So, it's judiciary is one, then executive is one. Who's the third one?
And legislature? No. No, actually, although you're not entirely incorrect. So, this is the Commons is one, of course, the House of Commons. And the Lord's Spiritual and the Lord's Temporal. So, the Lord's Spiritual is basically the Church of England and the Lord's Temporal is the House of Lords, right? The peers. So, those are the three key estates of the English establishment. And the fourth estate, as Edmund Burke put it, is the media, who's supposed to be the watchdog on these three estates. Right? So,
correct.
That's why the media is called the fourth estate. Now, the fourth pillar also is alternately used, as you rightly said, but the fourth estate is the name of it.
Could you repeat again, what were the three pillars, the House of Commons?
So, the Commons is one, and the other two are the Lord's Spiritual and the Lord's Temporal. So, the Lord's Spiritual is basically the Church of England, and the Lord's Temporal is the House of Lords, right? The upper house of the English Parliament, British Parliament.
Okay, their Rajya Sabha.
Their Rajya Sabha.
That just reminds me randomly of the fact that I had read a while back. Again, I can't verify it right now, but possibly you might have heard it. The fact that right now how we describe ideologies as, left and right, the reason is pretty much because the left ideologies and the right ideologies were sitting in the parliament. Like their actual position in the parliament. They were sitting towards the left-hand side, so they became left. And those which belong to the right ideology were sitting towards the right.
Absolutely right, which is exactly how it is.
All right. So, Abhinav, that brings us to the end of this episode. But there is one tiny matter of the audience question.
And then I need to tell you the theme as well later.
So the audience has heard all the questions. The first one was one flew over the cuckoo's nest. So the second one was... Never the Twain Shall Meet. And that was by Rudyard Kipling. Then the third one was our Fisher. French Count D'Artagnan.
Yeah.
Alexander Dumas. And now we had Jeffrey Archer. So these are all authors of repute. Is that the theme?
No, that's not the theme. Can't be authors of the theme. But if you look at the answers. One flew over the cuckoo's nest. Never the twain shall meet. The three musketeers and the fourth.
Oh, okay. Right? That was beautiful.
So there you go.
That was beautiful. So.
So the fifth question, therefore, we'll give it away. But over to you.
Yeah. So you can ask the question now, and for our listeners who think they have cracked the answer and who have figured out the all the hints that have been laid across for us, all you have to do is send in your answers to @QuizTimeIndia on Facebook and on Instagram, or on the other handle, which is @PodcastStudio41 on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can tweet or you can DM us the answer, and we will pick out one winner. That's how we normally do it. So Abhinav, please ask your last question or the audience question.
Sure. Thank you, Aditya. So, this is about a person called Claude Voilier. Again, French author, Claude Voilier, who was born André Labadon. So, she's a lady, actually, who wrote under a male pseudonym, as some people did back in the day. So, we'll call her Claude Voilier, which was the pen name. So, Claude Voilier was a prolific short story writer in French. But is best known in the Anglophone world, the English-speaking world, for her continuation of a certain series of novels, right, which she had initially translated into French after the original author's death.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was she started translating that author's works into French, and then once the original author died, she started a continuation series in French.
Yeah. Mm.
And so from 1971 to 1985, in 15 years, and all of this was after the original author died, she produced 25 novels originally in French, right? And 18 of which were then translated into English by Anthea Bell. Anthea Bell, of course, we know as the translator of Asterix along with Derek Hockridge. So Anthea Bell actually translated 18 of these 25 novels from French back to English. So it's a lovely coincidence, right, that the original novels got translated from English to French, and then the continuation part was originally written in French by the same author and then translated back into English by Anthea Bell. Lovely coincidence in the literary world. So the question is, which series are we talking about?
All right, so that is the question. That is the question, the name of the series, which went all over the place from English to French and
basically made two rounds of the English Channel.
Absolutely, you could put it that way.
Dover to Calais and then came back to Dover.
So you have to send in the answers, as I mentioned, @QuizTimeIndia on Facebook and on Instagram. And this is a Podcast Studio 41 podcast. So @PodcastStudio41 on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And Abhinav, thank you so much for taking out the time for doing this. It has been an absolute pleasure. And I must say, if I can say that it's one of the episodes that I really enjoyed. Thank you for putting the effort for coming up with these questions. And I enjoy the questions. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Pleasure was mine, Aditya. Like I said, it's a privilege to be on this podcast. I've seen some of the other people who preceded me on this. So it's quite lovely to be part of that distinguished list. And thank you very much for your questions. Loved what you came up with as well. So really, really enjoyed it. And thanks to the audience as well for being there.
And this marks the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. The fact that you're still here and you're still listening tells me you did enjoy it. And once again, I'd like to remind you, share this podcast, share this episode with your friends, family and colleagues, people who you think will enjoy it. share it on social media, share it on WhatsApp. This is me, Aditya, signing off. Thank you for your time. You can thank me for mine.